thank you very much for coming out on a Father's Day Sunday with good weather and plenty of other things to do. And I especially appreciate the time contributed by Rabbi Weber and by Jay Pasternak, who I will introduce in turn as we come to their parts of the panel. This is a topic that's near and dear to me. And has been for quite a few years. And it begins with a section of the Torah called the Parsha of Ki Tetzeh. Every week we have this Parsha, the weekly Torah portion, and each week there are certain portions that spur certain questions. And one is called Ki Tetzeh. And Ki Tetzeh always triggers certain questions in my mind, and I think in many people's minds, regarding a section of the Torah portion that's called Ben Sorer Umoreh. Ben Sorer Umoreh describes a boy of the age of roughly 12, 11 and 3 quarters, 12, whatever exactly the age is its own discussion, who rebels against his parents, steals, eats a lot of meat, drinks a lot of wine, is described biblically as Zolel Vissovei, he's gluttonous and he's a drunkard, and the Torah actually condemns him to death out of concern that he might go kill somebody in pursuit of his next fix. Now, the majority view Talmudically is that this can't happen, and it's designed biblically not to be able to happen. In other words, this is meant to be a moral lesson. It's meant to warn us about a danger. It's not something that's meant to be carried out. What exactly are they warning us about? Well, if you look in the Talmud at the description of this Ben Sorer Umoreh, you find certain factors about his experience, certain factors about his situation that are warning signs. We're talking about somebody who eats and drinks to excess. He has meat and wine that are readily accessible. It's not something he has to go far to get. It's right at hand. He has a place to eat the meat and to drink the wine without being disturbed. The wine is of significant quality so that it draws him in. And the conclusion that the Torah draws is that because he has this quality material available, because he has it readily accessible, because he has a place where he can eat it and feel safe, the result is that he ends up addicted to it and becomes more dangerous as he tries to feed his habit. Well, at some point, as I read that year after year, as the Torah portion came up, I realized that if these are the fixings of addiction, then we often, within the Jewish community, provide our children and ourselves as adults with the fixings of addiction. We create a place in which children have this and are able to reach it and are able to consume it safely without concern for being disturbed. I don't mean to be alarmist by it. Most of our children and adults will be fine, and I think Jay can speak to that more than I can in terms of what the statistics are. But we do endanger children as well as adults who are perhaps particularly vulnerable to this. Because of biology or because of stresses in their lives. So that before moving to Toronto, I had a shul in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and at the suggestion of AA members who were in the synagogue there, we established a Jack's chapter. It regularly drew quite a few people. And I attended a meeting at one point at which I heard strong criticism of rabbis specifically, either for enabling addiction or for turning a blind eye to people who obviously needed help. Because the truth of the matter is that the path to addiction is not bizarre and it's not exotic, and it can snare anyone, people who are successful, people who everybody thinks are fine. A person is undergoing stress, a person is undergoing pain, and I'm not speaking now as a counselor with the experience that Jay has. I'm speaking just as someone who saw this in my own community. You have somebody who's maybe a wealthy businessman, but God forbid loses a child at birth. You have a popular community leader going through domestic strife. You have a successful mother who's battling depression. Everyone has pain. And sometimes people find that drinking takes away some of the ability to think about their pain. And then within the community, people offer drinks all the time. Whether it's a tikkun in the morning after davening, whether it's a kiddush in shul, the kiddush club by the lockers. I had someone who actually sent me an email. He said he can't be here tonight, but he wanted to know, would I mention specifically kiddush clubs? So For you, I mentioned it. You can hear it on the audio. But you have wine available or liquor available at a Shalom Zachar, at a Bris. Free alcohol is all around. How hard is it to think that a person could, for a person, this could become an escape from pain? And so I've wanted to do this program because it's such a common phenomenon in the Jewish community. I would recommend three things from my own experience, and then I'm going to turn it over to the rest of the panel. Number one is that within the community, to make sure that we don't accidentally, unintentionally force alcohol on people. And this is something that's important because people come to the Shabbat table and there's a nice bottle of wine that's opened up and the wine is distributed around and the bottle is passed around the table. People feel a certain pressure, like they're supposed to imbibe. Someone brings out a bottle of scotch and says, here, you got to try this. People feel a certain degree of pressure, so that it's important to have grape juice available at the Shabbos table and to make sure that it's clear to people that they can choose to drink or not to drink as they wish. Number two, and again, I think Jay has probably a lot of experience with this, is to talk to children at an early age in an age-appropriate way so that they understand what this can do. It's not as easy as telling kids to avoid poison, because telling kids to avoid poison, they don't see anybody drinking poison. They do see people drinking this. And then number three is that if one thinks that someone has an issue, someone within the community, it's important to consult people who know who can help. And those things are all important. So I'm glad that we have people here for this discussion. Frankly, 15 minutes ago I was a little bit concerned. They were a lot bit concerned. But thank you very much for coming out. And again, I want to thank Rabbi Weber and Jay Pasternak for agreeing to serve as our panelists. I'm going to begin with Rabbi Weber, the Mara de Asra of the I suppose Mara de Asra, leading authority of Clanton Park, the rabbi of the shul, as well as a very good friend. Rabbi Weber, aside from being the rabbi of the shul here, is a former high school teacher and youth program director, and in those roles, as well as rabbi of the shul, member of community vad and rabbinic councils, has seen addiction issues and has seen the issues that arose in their wake at all of life's stages. And so I've asked Rabbi Weber to speak about it from the perspective of Judaism and the Torah and the various legal issues and philosophical issues that arise in terms of the role that alcohol plays in Judaism.
Rabbi. Thank you. So firstly, allow me to preface by thanking Rabbi Katrina for really organizing this. I'm attending, but really the effort and a lot of effort goes into this is really his, and both Jay Pasternak and Zalman Goldman, who spent quite a bit of time with me discussing both issues in the community and a general perspective on alcoholism and addiction. My exposure to alcoholism actually first arose well before I went into Rabbanus. Growing up, I really had no inkling that this problem existed. I mean, I knew it existed out here in the world, but I never saw it, not within my school or shul, or maybe I just didn't notice. But when I was in my mid-20s, the doors to Russia were opening for the Jewish world. It was glasnost and perestroika, and they began bringing in Jewish students, and I was one of those kids. I think the yeshiva that I was in, Chaim Berlin, was looking to send somebody, and no one else really agreed, and I did. And so I ended up spending a 2 weeks right before Pesach in Kiev. And I remember that on the flight there was a whole hubbub about dozens and dozens of people in Kiev dying from having drunk tainted perfume. And I didn't quite understand why in the world you'd be drinking perfume. And so the people began explaining that there was this crackdown on vodka that Gorbachev, this is 25 years ago, was trying to stem some of the problems. And he limited the sale of vodka, and people just couldn't function without it. So they had begun drinking perfume, and it had become the thing to do. You would go to parties and serve perfume, strange as it sounds. And some of it was tainted, and dozens of people died. And even after people began dying, the drinking continued. And when I came to this strange netherworld, it was a terrible place, Kiev. I went back a few times after that. I understood why. There was a lot to escape from. People sometimes have challenges, but they find frequently areas of life in which there's some satisfaction. I think most people living in the former Soviet Union had no satisfaction from any life arena. So you didn't have religion, and religion can go ahead and create great satisfaction. Very few people had strong emotional support. Families, by and large, were broken into shards. The difficulties of daily life destroy families, and even those that were together, at least the ones that I was exposed to, really seemed broken. The economic level was beyond awful. The Soviet Union was poorer than people thought. And so, you know, I came to understand, and then I also noticed that people don't just escape into alcohol. It had become their area of expertise. And so when people would get together, and they were able to get bottles of vodka, it's what they talked about, it's what they celebrated, it's what they focused on. It was the highlight of the evening. So even if people were able to put together a meal of something, and there was some important American food that I brought with me, it was secondary to the alcohol. That was it, that defined it. And it was an exposure, because I'd never seen it, never understood it. And then I went into Rabbanis, and you begin seeing life, and you begin seeing things that other people don't. And so both in my prior community in Queens and here, I've seen alcoholism at every stage. I've seen it among kids in high school. I've seen it among adults. I've seen it among men and women. Nice, clean-cut, you know, high-functioning mothers who are institutionalized because of real, real issues. And, you know, the numbers, that's really for Jay to share with you. But what I see anecdotally is that you're dealing with a significant problem within the community. And there are no simple solutions. But one thing that I've begun to focus on and notice is that, you know, there are many reasons that people are drawn to alcohol. And sometimes, again, there's a need, there's a break, there's suffering, and alcohol might address that. But sometimes people celebrate alcohol. And I've seen that here in our community, and I think this might be true in the world of synagogues in general now. People get together at a kiddush, and they talk about the scotch, and they discuss it at length, and they'll spend hundreds of dollars on a bottle of scotch, and I will tell you, even thousands of dollars. And I see this before Pesach. I remember way back when, you know, people sell their chametz before Pesach. They sit down with the rabbi, they go ahead and say that I've got X numbers of boxes of pasta out, you know, sitting in the corner of my kitchen, and I've got a bottle or two of scotch, and the rabbi goes ahead and says, well, that's worth about $2.50, and you sign a contract, and it's all sold, and you can keep it over Passover, because we don't keep these things over Passover. But then I began sitting down with people who told me, rabbi, it's $2.50, it's $3,000, or $10,000, and I say, you're kidding, and they tell me, rabbi, get with the program. You know, there's good stuff out there. Now, not everyone is drinking that. Not everyone who goes ahead and has $1,000 bottles is an alcoholic. But we in our community, with disposable income, with affluence that really was unprecedented, have begun channeling some of that income and some of that affluence towards alcohol. And it's become something that people celebrate. It's something that kids notice and that kids talk about. And I think that might be part of the problem. But these are broad issues. My focus tonight really should be some of the halachic issues. You have rabbis, and it's you know, if there's a question, it's for you to go to your specific rabbi. But I can tell you some of the issues that I grapple with, and really it's a journey, and I haven't really come to a full conclusion. Purim is a great conundrum for me. And let me tell you where I stand now. And I might not stand here 5 years from now. At my table on Purim, there is wine, the bottles are open, I drink, and I'm comfortable with having my teenage kids drink. It's something I was raised with. Now, some of you were raised with this. To some of you, this sounds odd beyond belief. So a little bit of halachic background. Purim is the one day of the Jewish year that was structured as a day of frivolity. It celebrates our survival. It celebrates us escaping from something that could have been some type of ancient Holocaust. Wine played a great role in the story then. It continued to play a great role in Purim as it evolved over the years. And indeed, there's a Gemara in Megillah, Daf Zayin, where the Gemara with the Talmud goes ahead and tells us one is obligated to go ahead and drink on the day of Purim. Now, the term the Gemara uses is a little bit odd. It doesn't say that one is obligated to drink. It says one is obligated to sweeten oneself, or put oneself in good spirits, or go ahead and make oneself comfortable on Purim. And the commentaries step in and say this means drinking wine far beyond what you normally drink. another truth is, our early commentators grappled with this. Some of them said, this is a very odd thing. Religion is about responsibility, and it's about lines, and it's about being intellectually aware and in control, and excessive drinking really, you know, is that's not what it's about. And so some of them actually went ahead and took the very unusual step of saying, you know, there's a Gemara here, there's a piece of Talmud that says what it says, but it's not part of the halachic envelope. They point out that although there's this Gemara that talks about the obligation to party ad infinitum on Purim, that story in the Talmud is followed by yet another story which talks about two great rabbis who came together and did party ad infinitum on Purim, and there were terrible results. Come Rabbi Shachtil or Gzeira. One rabbi got up and killed the other rabbi. Now, whether he did kill him or whether it's a metaphor for something, you know, uncomfortable happening, but something really bad happened. And so a number of authorities, significant authorities, Rabbi Ephraim was quoted by the Ran and by the Balamor and by the Meiri, goes ahead and says the awful story that follows the halachic discussion is the Gemara's way of saying that the halachic discussion is moot. There was an attempt to institute a day of frivolity. The response was, this is not going to work, and we pull back. And so there are such lines of thinking. But as this developed within the halachic realm, the classic halachic authorities, Shulchan Aruch, Rambam, do seem to go ahead and build this into the halachic envelope. And so Shulchan Aruch and Rambam and Ramah do go ahead and include the obligation to drink on Purim within our halachic envelope. Now, why am I raising this at a Jackson, really? Because this is probably the area in Orthodoxy in which you'll have the most tension between, you know, what common sense seems to say and what Orthodoxy seems to say. And so let's go ahead and sort of put this in perspective. Firstly, this obligation, as it's taken in the yeshiva world today, in the world of young Orthodox kids today, is far beyond what the Gemara presented. The Gemara does not present becoming stone drunk on Purim. The Gemara recommends having a meal and serving wine at the meal. They didn't have scotch. They didn't have vodka. They didn't have anything that was stronger than 18% because they didn't have the wherewithal to create things that were stronger than 18%. So what the Gemara seems to say is have your one day in which really you let loose. Life is tough. There's a lot of studying. There's a lot of working. Have your day. But it's much more limited than the partying that goes on at the bar. What you use is limited. Yeah. So we'll get there actually, because you know, and we can't ignore that. So firstly, I must tell you, this Ad Lo Yada is read on many levels. Some will go ahead and say the Rambam and the Ramah both go ahead and say it doesn't really mean that. What it means is drink and you'll become drowsy and you'll fall asleep, and maybe they're sort of superimposing their own, you know, wishes on what the Gemara seems to say. There's Naruch Shulchan who says that he only really says that because, you know, the Gemara has that horrible story afterwards. Others say that the Gemara doesn't really mean that, but it means sort of approaching that level, but not really getting there. But again, you're right, it's there. But let's put it in perspective. It's within the context of a meal, and again, you're not using something very potent. You're using wine. And 12%, I think it would go up to 18%. I don't think they had the wherewithal to distill things beyond that. And Rashi goes out of his way to say that we're dealing with wine. And again, it's within the context of a meal. So it's not Purim night, it's Purim day. It's only at that meal. Anything beyond the meal would be forbidden. There are authorities now. I would say Rabbi Tversky. There are authorities that go ahead and say, you know, the Gemara says what it says, Shulchan Aruch says what it says, but with the strains and the tensions of modern life, cars and accidents and alcoholism and the real issues and mixing medications and the fact that, you know, the soft drink can lead to hard drinking, which can lead to hard drugs, maybe halacha has changed. And there is such a line developing within the classic Orthodox world. I'm not there yet. In terms of how I live my life, and in terms of how I was raised, you know, there's still wine on my table at Purim. And 5 years from now, I might shift. You know, I might grow, and, you know, the tension that I feel every Purim might pull me in a certain direction. Part of it is also that, you know, I wonder, there was we have experts here, and I've shared this with you actually as well when we met. And I was raised with a study that was done in pre-war Warsaw about alcoholism rates, and it's a famous study about, you know, rates that were markedly lower in the non-Jewish world than the Jewish world. And there was a lot of talk about why and how and where. And one of the understandings was that going, you know, completely closing the door, not having any exposure to alcohol, might create its own tensions. So in many, many traditional Jewish homes, you'll have some wine Friday night. You'll have your one day Purim. It's not really the forbidden fruit. And so perhaps that was the thinking of the rabbis that set this in place. But again, I will tell you it's a work in progress. But the objective here is to really deal with issues and not to make believe. This is probably the most significant issue in the Jewish world. This is where I stand now. And it's a controversial stand, because there are those, and I reiterate, who've gone ahead and say, no, we should shift away. I'm not comfortable going there yet. And I haven't. I will go ahead and say, no, that if someone knows he has this inclination, he knows this runs in the family, he knows that for his kids it's going to be a challenge, then it makes absolutely no sense to go there. But on the other hand, to go ahead and get a blanket prohibition, I'm not going to be the one spearheading that. There are other halakhic points that are much smaller. Wine is completely irrelevant Friday night. In my home, I grew up with it. We're comfortable with it. I don't see that there are challenges. And so I do make kiddush on wine. But I will tell you, Rabbi Tirchin very cleverly pointed out, and it's something I'm going to start doing. We have guests. And after I make kiddush, you know, we hand the wine around. And it never dawned on me that one of them might be a struggling alcoholic, and I should present an option that is not threatening. And it's probably wise to have grape juice on the table as well. And the same is true for the Seder. So there are some authorities that say that, you know, there's something superior about having wine. And it's true. But grape juice is certainly acceptable. That's going to be an honor. The real issue is Purim, yeah. So what's interesting is Simchas Torah is a non-halachic, to the best of my knowledge. There's no halachic basis for drinking on Simchas Torah. I'm not sure how this morphed. Purim has its sources, and they're there, and you've got to deal with them. Simchas Torah is something that sort of took off by itself, and has no halachic base, and the truth is, it's disconcerting, because it's viewed as something halachic, and it's not. Now, people want to drink themselves, you know, and become stone drunk, don't blame God. You know, there's enough to blame God for. So Purim is there, we got to deal with that. Simchas Torah is not part of the halachic, you know, equation. It doesn't have a halachic base. Okay, but again, you know, this needs a lot of thought. Do we go ahead and close the door completely? And so, do shul kedushim go totally? Do you not make kiddush and walk in shul anymore as a statement that we as a community will never go there because there have been problems? Will that go ahead and lower the rate of alcoholism? I'm not really sure. I will say what I can share is that what we have to do is stop glorifying it. So the discussions in shul, at the kiddush club, you know, where people pull out very expensive bottles, and kids see, so they see their fathers going down to the kiddush club. They know they're doing something that's, you know, not really absolutely right, because, you know, they go to school, they learn, they know you go to Davin, you come at 9, you leave at 11:30, they're not supposed to be doing that. They're going to a corner somewhere and pulling out a bottle in a brown bag, and they're talking about it. It sends the wrong message, and there's no halakhic base for that. And so there's no tension. That's a great big problem. And the more difficult issues are, there is X percent of the community that is really struggling. So whether it's 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 20, there are alcoholics. And that's tough. And so you are an alcoholic, and you've got it under control, and you go to your meetings, and they help you keep things under control. And then Shabbos comes, and there's an urge, or there's a drive, or you're in a situation. And you can't really move past it yourself. And there's no meeting within walking distance. Can you hop in the car and go where you need to go? And the answer would probably be, my answer would be, that if indeed the situation is critical and the person can't get past it, yeah, he'd have the right to do what he needs to do. You know, if he can walk there, if he can get there with transportation, with the taxi, but if he's got to, you know, take, you know, vehicle A to get to where he needs to get, that would be halakhically acceptable. And that puts the entire thing in perspective, because, you know, we, religious Jews are really, really careful about Shabbos. Shabbos matters. You don't go ahead and cross the line unless you absolutely have to. You do it to save somebody's life. And if a rabbi gives a psak like that, and I don't think I'd be the only rabbi giving a psak like that, the underlying statement is that you're dealing with life and death. And so if someone is, you know, within that world, and this is their challenge, that, in my mind, would be something that if they have to do it, they can do it.
Ordinary things
And I would venture to say that to a large degree I concur. And so, again, I reiterate that vis-a-vis Purim, and, you know, every rabbi has his own, we still celebrate Purim the traditional way, with mixed feelings, because I've been to institutions, I've seen alcoholism, I've seen all the horrors that come in its wake. But, you know, Kiddush Friday night in my home is on wine. I prefer wine to grape juice. And I, at this point, I think my children do. Well, that's something I was raised with. We do celebrate a traditional Purim. At the meal, at the table, nothing beyond that. I don't think it's raucous, but we do. And because of this feeling that it worked for me growing up, it seems to be working for me. But I say this with bated breath, because I do hear the perspective of serious people like Rabbi Twersky, who say that the horrors of alcoholism might involve shutting the door. I mean, this is really, you know, this goes back to the prohibition. That's part of it. You know, how do you stop this monster? Do you go ahead and close the door completely? Do you try to find balance? I concur with you, but I think others would disagree.
I'm going to ask for further questions to wait till the end, just because we still have another panelist. Rabbi, is that right? So I'm going to ask Jay Pasternak to be our third speaker. Jay actually came to me through Zalman Goldman, who I had initially recruited for this, and Zalman said he can certainly do it, but Jay's my man. And I'm very glad to have been introduced to Jay. We've had a chance to talk a little bit, as Rabbi Weber had a chance also to talk to him. Jay's been counseling youth, adults, and families within the Jewish community and general public for the past 20 years. He has designed and delivered programs for institutions and agencies such as the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, Mimico Correctional Institute, Ontario Hydro. He's been a workshop facilitator at many Hebrew schools as well as public schools around the GTA. Currently, he has taken on the position of Director of Programming for JACS and is also Clinical Director of a private 7-bed men's recovery house and continues with his private practice. And I'm very grateful to Jay for contributing his time this evening to be here on the panel.
Thanks very much. I want to thank Rabbi Weber, Rabbi Tortina, for inviting JACS out, inviting myself out, and out to the community. I want to thank everyone who's here tonight. I know it's Father's Day. There's lots going on. It's Sunday evening. And it's a difficult topic. You know, it's an uncomfortable topic. You know, talking to your kids about drugs and alcohol. Talking to somebody you think might have a problem with drugs and alcohol. Talking to a husband or wife or whoever it is. It's a difficult topic. I like what's been said so far about different communities, the way we view things. You know, and I think one of the things in general, when we say the word alcoholic, right, you have a picture in your head. I said alcoholic, drug addict, right? You got a picture. There's a connotation, right? What do you think of? Can anyone tell me, when I say alcoholic, what's that picture that you get? What is it? A bum. Okay. Somebody else? Yeah. Bum. Out of control. Lined up at the liquor store at 9 o'clock in the morning. Can't hold a job. Right. What else?
Dysfunctional.
What else?
Unhappy.
Pardon me?
Unhappy.
Sure. Right. Always looking for that next drink or that next drug. Preoccupation. Alcohol withdrawal or delirium tremens, DTs as we call it, drug addicted withdrawal, right? So just the very word itself, alcoholic, alcoholism, has certain connotations. And really today we really try to get away from that because it doesn't serve a purpose. Okay? What's it, they say in 12-step programs, what's the difference between an alcoholic and somebody who gets drunk? An alcoholic goes to meetings. What that really means is somebody's already said, you know what, I have a problem. I'm going to call myself an alcoholic because I'm sitting in a room with a lot of people who are very similar, who've identified the same problems in their life, and I've said, I'm an alcoholic. If I walked over to somebody at a Kiddush club and said, buddy, you know, you're an alcoholic, what do you think they'd say to me? Exactly. You're crazy. What are you talking about? I know an alcoholic. He lives down the hall from me. That guy's an alcoholic, right? He's got a problem. He fits what I think an alcoholic is. Although I drink too much, and I really don't mean to drink too much, it just starts out, you know, I'm going to have a few,
at the Kiddush Club or the holiday or the Shabbos meal or something. And you know what? Yeah, I drink too much. But I'm okay because, you know, I don't beat my wife or I don't, take too many other pills or, I go to sleep. You know, I'm a quiet kind of guy and that's what it is, right? Although the kids may say something different, the children may say, Dad's not available, he wakes up hungover in the morning, we can't talk to him all of Saturday. When there's these holidays, there's no going near him. He made sure he's got his, whatever he needs to drink, because he's got a marked amount that he's going to drink, or she's going to drink, or the kids are going to drink. So there's certain signs and symptoms that we become aware of around somebody's drinking, right, or drug use. As far as it goes in the Jewish community, often people ask me, well, what's the difference between the Jewish community and other communities? Jewish community is a little smaller, especially in Toronto. So probably somebody who drinks is going to stand out. Their symptoms will stand out a little taller. But in general, we're probably like in every other community, right? If you look at it per capita, per person, if you look at 1,200 kids in one school and 20% of them are abusing drugs or alcohol. And usually, typically, when we talk about schools these days, we're talking much more around drugs because drugs are a lot easier to get than alcohol. It's much easier to get a bag of marijuana at school than it is a bottle of booze. Okay. Probably you'll look at probably the same percentage in other schools, right, in Hebrew schools per capita. Similar, maybe a little bit less because our margin, our girth of acceptability is a little narrower in the Orthodox and Jewish community. So we may see a little bit less, but typically around similar numbers. I think the phenomenon that we've seen in Toronto for the past 10 years anyway is our girth on acceptable drug use has gotten much wider since they decriminalized, or the police were told, basically, we're trying to move much more towards a World Health Organization. It's a mental health problem, right? Rather than a punitive, correctional, put them in jail problem, which I happen to agree with. I believe that people with the problem with alcohol, that it's not the alcohol. The bottle of booze sitting on the table is the bottle of booze. You know, if you drink it and I drink it and I happen to have a susceptibility to it because there's learning issues or there's mental health issues or I'm new generation Canadian issues or there's financial issues or I come from a separated blended family issues or there's, a multifaceted myriad of problems, that alcohol in that bottle does something for me that it doesn't do for you. For some reason, my endorphin levels go off the map. And after two or three, I'm saying, bring on the rest of the booze. And you're going, I've had enough. I think I'm like okay with these two or three. And I'm actually, getting a little nauseous. One person, genetically, endorphin levels go up. They call it THIQ, which changes alcohol into morphine, right? Their levels go up. That's the genetic factor they think about. They think they've got a handle on. Somebody else doesn't have that genetic predisposition. Their endorphin levels don't go up as much. So they don't get that great a buzz from it. But then again, we look at it biopsychosocial. Biologically, what's going on biologically for the person? Have they eaten that day? So we know somebody who eats. I do a drunk driver's group. Used to do a drunk driver's group for Mimico Correctional. And the guys would tell me, not every time they drink do they get into trouble. But every time they've gotten into trouble, they've been drinking. So for them, alcohol's become not a problem every time, but in certain situations. What are the situations? They'll tell me, if I stop for a drink on my way home from work, chances are probably pretty good I'm going to be there for 4 or 5 hours. Because once I start drinking on an empty stomach, I can't stop it. The alcohol, the endorphin, whatever goes on for them just keeps building and building. But if I go home first and I have dinner, and I relax and I let go of some of the stressors of the day, and then I go out and have a beer or two, it's usually a beer or two. So in your context around having a meal with it, makes sense, right? People don't get typically some people don't get as shikkered as, or whatever we call it in Yiddish, as drunk as somebody, as somebody who is drinking on an empty stomach. And that's one of the harm reduction, when we talk about harm reduction strategies with people is, you know, drink with food. Don't drink on an empty stomach. Don't drink more than 1.5 ounces per hour. Don't mix drinks with medications, right? Especially antidepressants. Don't operate farm equipment when you're drinking. No, that's a joke. Okay. But they'll say certain things on the labels, which is kind of true. You know, a guy will come up to me and say, man, I was so drunk the other night. I'm so glad I had my car. There's no way I could have walked home. Right? And that's what it was 20 years ago, right? Before seatbelts were around, things like that. That's the way we kind of looked at alcohol as a problem. Today, the level of awareness, the information, the internet, the amount of resources. Before Jack's came around, I've been around 12-step programs for 20, 25 years now with my own substance use history. And before Jack's came around, I have to tell you, whether it was an Alcoholics Anonymous or a Narcotics Anonymous, I didn't really see a lot of keepas in the room. You know, maybe they were hiding. You know, they were taking their keepas off beforehand. But it just wasn't that acceptable. And that's why Jack's really started in New York about 30 years ago, because Jewish people were having a bit of a problem, because typically it was community centers, but more so churches were opening up their doors to the community to hold meetings. And Jack's started in New York really about 30-odd years ago, so Jewish people could have a place where they could go that was non-denominational, that it wasn't looked at. And then we've always got a contingency that'll say, oh no, there's an alcoholics meeting in a synagogue. I can't go to the synagogue. People will know me. Right? So Jack's in Toronto anyway opened up its doors to be really a non-judgmental living room kind of environment for people. It's like Bubby's living room. Come and be safe. You know, come and talk about whatever it is you need to talk about in a non-judgmental, non-opinionated atmosphere. Although we have opinions, we try not to. You know what, come back, have a cup of tea kind of environment. And that's what Jax has tried to create in Toronto. I think we've done a pretty good job. You know, we'll have 30 people at a family meeting on a Tuesday night. I went to a men's meeting this morning. There was about at least 15 guys in there, ages from 17 to 70. And they're there. It's a men's meeting, so it's open to anybody who wants to talk about pretty much anything that would affect a man. So it could be relationships, could be drugs, could be sex, could be gambling, could be their workload, it could be their grandchildren, it could be anything. And I guess Jack's, you know, because it's open and it's available, we've seen kind of people coming and coming and coming, and the more they come, the more they tell their friends. We don't have a lot of advertising. I don't know if you've seen, have you ever seen Jack's ads out there?
Yes.
Yeah. Raise your hand if you've seen our ads. Wow, I'm more shocked than ever. Right? I've seen them too, right? We helped develop them. But for most people, they haven't. Jack's is kind of the best kept secret in Toronto, right? We've got, right now, I think we're running with 10 groups a week that are run by therapists, counselors like myself, social workers, family therapists, and we have about 10 groups a week that we rent space out to. I think because the resources have become much more wider, it's become more acceptable to get help. Right? At one time, it was a real shunda in the Jewish community to come and get help for almost anything. Right? We just did a workshop for rabbis about a month and a half ago, and every rabbi in the room said, I have people who come to me with alcohol and drug problems, and I don't counsel them. Why? Because I don't know how. I'm not trained in that field, but thank God Jax is there. Thank God there's some addiction physicians in the Jewish community. Thank God we have some mental health units that are open to dealing with substance abuse as a mental health issue. And they will refer there. I think before that, before about 10 years ago, it was a rabbi's kind of domain. You know, and I think still is. It still is. There's a lot of people who won't come forward and go to a come out to even a meeting like this. You know, does this stigmatize you? You know, that there must be, if you're here tonight, you must have somebody in your family who's got a drug or alcohol problem, otherwise you wouldn't be here. No, the reality is, drugs and alcohol affect all of our lives. It affects all of our lives. for every person who has a drug or alcohol problem, there's a minimum of 6 people who are affected. Let me ask you just quickly. Raise your hand if you know somebody who had a problem with drugs or alcohol. Raise your hand if you knew somebody who had a problem with drugs or alcohol. So most of the room. Raise up your hand if that person's sitting beside you. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. How many people, let me ask something, I'll go way out on a limb. How many people know somebody who went for some help? How many people know somebody? So about half of the amount of people who know somebody, right, who probably had or has had a problem. Okay. Most of us are affected by it in some way, shape, or form. Most of us are affected. What else can we do at Jack's? Let me just jump on Jack's a little bit, because that's why I'm here. I can plug Jack's a little bit. So at Jack's, we have open groups. We have closed groups that people get invited to. Our two main groups that we find are the most helpful are Thursday night is for adults, primarily. So anybody who thinks they have a problem, anybody who thinks somebody else has a problem and they want to get some help for them, that's our Thursday night. We run a Sunday night teen group as well, and that's for any kids that want to just come, right? And it ranges from, I don't have a problem, but I want to get some volunteer hours. That's kind of a little bit of our hook to get them in. To kids who have fairly severe problems but don't want to talk to their parents, right? Don't want to talk to their parents. And oftentimes we'll get kids coming in, and the parents will call us a few days later saying, you know, my kid's over at Jack's. What are you guys doing with my kid? My kid doesn't do drugs or drink or whatever. And say, well, they're here to learn how to help other people in their grade, I guess. I don't know. It's confidential. Right. So, you know, Jack's is kind of set up in a way that we try to preserve anonymity and confidentiality, and we try to meet somebody where they're at, rather than in AA, you basically have to come in, you know, pretty much saying, you know what, this is kind of like the last house on the block, you know? I've tried counseling, and I've tried psychiatry, and I've tried, you know? You walk into an AA meeting, you're walking in saying, you know, I got a problem here. You know, whatever you guys call yourselves, I can relate to you. You know, I got that same problem. And addiction's probably it's a strange phenomenon. It's the only problem that tells us we don't have a problem. It's a, you know, it tells us, well, if my wife loved me more, if my husband made more money, if my job, if they understood me at work, life would be better. If I had a better car, girlfriend, husband, wife, you know, then life would be okay and I wouldn't drink as much. The person gets that and they're still drinking. Now, for 80% of us, it's not a problem. 8 out of 10 people, 87% of Torontonians have had a drink in the last 6 months. That's some stats that we have, right? So Toronto's a drinking place, right? Actually, our society is a using society. There's a great book written by Ann Wilson Chafe called When Society Becomes an Addict. And it's very true that we've grown up on medications, right? I think Ontario is the highest percentage of codeine users in Canada. In Ontario, specifically North York. No, I'm just joking. No, specifically Ontario, we use more codeines and painkillers, I think, than any other province per capita. Right? That came out of KMH, and it came out of the Substance Abuse Bureau in Ottawa. Right?
How old is that stuff?
Pardon me? It was just 2 months ago. It's still on. It's probably still on the web if you want to look it up. It was in the Gospel of Toronto Star, right? But no, it was in the KMH stat and the Substance Abuse Bureau in Ottawa. There's a big bureau.
It's going to increase. It's going to increase because you've got a boomer demographic that is going to increase in age and going to require in that population that will take them the painkiller use.
Yeah. I happen to agree with you, and in that same study, they looked at the difference between what parents thought their kids were doing and what the teens were doing. So kids, 18 and under. So one of the questions was, do you think your kids have used medications, prescription drugs, from your medicine cabinet? Right. 95% of parents said no. 35% of kids said yes. So there was a little bit of a difference between the way parents see their teens and the way kids, you know, and what kids are actually doing. Right? Again, when we look at solutions, okay, so we have a problem, like every society. There's about 15%, there's 80% that are going to get through drug and alcohol experimentation, use and abuse without a problem. right? They'll have problems, but 8 out of 10 don't have the other multidimensional problems that we see associated with ongoing use. You know, somebody, one of you drinks too much on a Sunday night, you wake up Monday morning, and you're hungover, and you say, man, I'm not doing that again. You know, I'm all hungover for work. 8 out of 10 of you can do that. And you probably won't get hungover again. You'll learn from that lesson. That was our yellow flashing light. There's about 15% of us that'll take a couple of lessons to learn. I was just telling the rabbi that when the seatbelt laws first came out, seatbelts, yeah, okay, fine. I was driving down Spadina, bombing down Spadina, got hit with a speeding ticket and no seatbelt, right? I'm like, oh my God, it was like $250 and I think points or something, right? Okay, from now on, always seatbelt. All 2 weeks later, Forest Hill Road, hit with another one, right? Takes me a little bit longer to learn. I happen to be in that 15% category. At one time, I was in the 5% that didn't learn, right? So we have people that are in that 15%, the abuse stage. Typically, when you talk to them, right, and you ask them things like, how come you drink so much? Right? What's happening? They'll talk to you. They'll talk to you. They're not defensive as much as someone else. Okay? They'll talk to you. And when you start to talk to them about how the alcohol or drugs have affected that you, right, whether it's a kiddish club or it's a Friday night or it's a Saturday or whatever day, whatever it is, hopefully you talk to them when they're not under the influence. And you talk about your feelings around their drinking, right? And what help other people have gotten. Whether it's bringing them to a Jack's Thursday night meeting, whether it's calling us and saying, Jay, you know what, is there a counselor I can bring by, my friend? I just want him to talk to somebody once or twice, right? Make some connection to you. Wherever it is, whoever it's with, an open AA meeting. You know, there's meetings like this where you just sit there and there's one person who gets up and speaks is a great idea. Right, and they'll probably identify. They'll probably identify with something going on, and something will twig for them. Right? There's another percentage of people that's about 5%, 1 out of 20, that's moved into a dependency stage, where the drugs or alcohol become a failed solution for them. Right? What's the difference between somebody in the abuse and dependency stage? I give this little anecdote. Somebody abusing drugs or alcohol comes into my office. I say, Zelman, you're abusing alcohol. If you keep abusing alcohol, we're going to have to cut your leg off tomorrow. Zelman says, Jay, what an idiot. They're not going to cut off my leg. He walks outside. He goes, oh my God, look at all these one-legged people walking around. Jay, serious, I better stop this, right? Or cut back a little bit, okay? And someone in that abuse stage can. Somebody who's moved into the dependency stage where they need it, right, comes into my office. And it's Brian, we'll say, my buddy Brian here. Right? Brian walks in. Brian says to me, Jay, blah, 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 blah. I say, Brian, you know, you're in the dependency stage. We're going to have to cut off your leg tomorrow if you keep drinking. Brian says, oh, Jay, what an idiot. They're not going to cut off my leg. He walks outside. He looks at all these one-legged people. He goes, oh, my God, Jay's right. Look at all these one-legged people. I better get really drunk. That's going to hurt tomorrow. People in the dependency stage, for whatever reason, have a harder time. The alcohol, the drugs have bonded with their neurochemistry, with their personality, with their lifestyle in such a way that they couldn't see giving it up at all. And that's when we look for more professional help. That's when we start sending people to treatment centers and detox centers. Because on their own, with an hour a week or whatever it is, whatever intervention it is, they have a really difficult time. They have a really hard time. And that's typically people that we see at Jack's, we see people who abuse, and we also do a lot of prevention work out in the schools, out in the community. I think we probably go to about 100 schools. We do camp trainings. We do community lectures and forums like this one. And we're always available. Now, I have a saying, your mind can only absorb what your rear can endure. So after about an hour, my mind starts to go, so I'm assuming your mind's kind of in that phase as well. So I'll stop talking now and turn it back over to
Thank you.
My host.
Thank you very much. just before I forget to mention, we'll take a couple of questions still, but there are Jack's brochures by the door. Also, Eva, right near the door in the yellow shirt, has our registration sheets for anyone who didn't sign in. It would be appreciated if you could. Are there questions for the panelists?
Anybody besides? No, I'm
kidding. You emphasize a lot about team problems and drinking. What I've never heard of is a team calling Jack's and saying, my father's an alcoholic, my mother's abusing pills. Is there such a call?
We actually, when Jack started our teen programs, we started it because we were getting parents, or we were getting aunts, uncles, friends. I'm glad you brought that up. It's a great point. We were getting parents, the kids of parents, or the kids of friends of parents, or relatives that were coming in. I think that, Zelman, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the very first group we started was like a siblings group. You know, it was for kids that were affected by their older brothers or sisters, or by their parents.
We went to a yeshiva high school where a girl pulled us aside afterwards and said, I found this pipe in my mother's drawer, the crack pipe. And it was just, now that we're here with all of these kids telling them about Jack, and they were coming out of the woodwork saying, we have all these problems, what should we do? We were forced to respond to our team program.
So probably about 20-odd percent, I'd say 2 out of 10 are coming for somebody else. Smaller percentage. Always, I'd say, maybe 1 out of 5 schools that I go to, somebody will come up to me afterwards and say, you know, my dad drinks too much. He's got an alcohol problem. Or my mother went to treatment, but she's still using oxys, or, you know, something. That's a good point, though. And that's a population that goes unheard. Yeah. Thanks, Harry.
What are the statistics for alcohol?
Way, really high. It's like hot. No, I'm kidding. You know what? I have no clue. We don't really. It's hard to gauge numbers, right, and get, like, real accurate statistics. And I think Eva does a lot of our stats, but we look more demographically around age. You know, I think it's a lot of our stuff's around age because we're trying to do groups more towards age and stage appropriate learning and psychotherapy and things like that. I would say probably the majority still goes. Would you think it goes to rabbis, or would you think they come out? Zelman gets more calls than anybody in the city of Toronto. I can tell you that much.
The rabbis, the pediatricians, the firm pediatricians get a lot of the calls. There's also there's a missing dynamic, and that's that a lot of the people we've seen, between 500 and 600 people a week now, and a lot of it is repeat business. They're continuing for meetings. But there's that young person or that person that's fallen from Orthodox graces, but they might have started out in a prom circle or in a yeshiva, and then because of their path, they got bounced from place to place. And we'll get a call from a parent saying, my kid goes to treatment, I want to make sure they have kosher food. He's living on the streets doing all the things that street people.
And we know how kosher cocaine is, right?
So there's that dynamic as well. So there's a lot of people that have a connection to the community, but whether they're still living an observant life is a difficult question to answer.
I think it's more, I don't want to say hidden, but it's a bigger shunda, I think, for somebody to come out from the Orthodox, maybe, than it is for somebody who from less, you know, less traditional, I guess. I don't know. I don't see a lot of people running into Jack's with kippahs. I see a lot more today than I did 10 years ago. And 20 years ago, I didn't see any coming into AA meetings. There were a few, but nothing. I can go to a workshop now, an addictions workshop for therapists and counselors, and probably see, I'd say, 15% are in the observant kind of conservative Orthodox community, and those are counselors. So, is there a problem? Yes, there is. Is it being addressed by our community? Yes, it is. Because 20 years ago, I didn't see anybody in school when I went to school for addictions, mental health, corrections. I didn't see anybody. Now, one of my buddies was running my halfway house 3 years ago. He just went off to New York to do his master's. He's Orthodox. We set up probably one of the first kosher kitchens in a recovery house for that. And it was great. Brian, yeah.
Well, I just go to the Methodist Clinic, and I'm being Reformed Jew, conservative, Orthodox, Israeli, Russians, over half of those, you know, clients there.
Yeah. And a lot of the methadone doctors up in this area, or in general, methadone's a replacement therapy for opiates. And a lot of them are Orthodox. A lot of the doctors are Orthodox. I would say the numbers in the last 20 years are growing of people using drugs. I think if we talk to KMH, they would say the numbers of people becoming dependent are less than it was 10 years ago, we'll say. But those people who are becoming dependent are using more substances, getting drunker more often, and using a greater variety of substances. So I think in general, there was a lull there for about mid-80s to mid-90s, I think around Just Say No, right, in the States, that Just Say No message, although it was a stupid message, it brought out a lot of awareness around drug use. And then I think 2000, 2005, we've seen an increase, especially around opiates, oxys. In the Orthodox community? Hard to tell. I can't really, you know, I couldn't really say... if there's been a greater increase of people getting help, that's for sure. Zelman talks to a lot more people than I do.
When we as a family came into recovery, I had a very good friend who was very close with H4C, and we called him. And there was really no one in Toronto to call. 10 years later, we see a significant number of people. There is still a transition where if someone gets in trouble, a lot of people will look for a solution. Maybe in Israel, we were in Israel recently, and I went to look to, when I was growing up, it was called the Tarzion, but I swear today they refer to it as Crack Square, and there are Jewish kids everywhere doing drugs. There are yeshivas that really, you know, I believe in Shin and Mach and Shin and Mazel, they're changing their location to change the written situation, but it only works if there's a real recognition of what the situation is. Change. You take a person who's in full-blown, you know, trouble and say, well, we'll send them off to Israel and send the problem there. It's not always a solution. It's definitely not a solution when they go with a friend that they were in trouble with here, which happens all too often, that a lot of these groups stay and gravitate together in different locations. But there's a lot more resources in Israel than there used to be as well. I've noticed Enoch Aden, there are Tikva, Sophia, Shimon Russell, Dr. Russell, who is here, who's one of the seminaries. This has been very active in the community, especially for young women, in terms of finding solutions for them. Which the man had a program that we were regularly sending people to as sort of a halfway solution, like they were coming out of rehab, and they were looking to be active, sorry, not my back. They were looking to be active in a recovery setting. There you had other young people that from all over North America where they could come together, they would learn in the morning, there was our meetings every day, they would train in the jobs. Many of those people, of those young men, come back and they have very easily integrated back into society and really dealt with a lot of their struggles. And a lot of their struggles were being specific, falling into the wrong crowd, the wrong time, you know, maybe some underlying issues that didn't get dealt with. Call it the square peg and the round hole syndrome in the schools, but kids just not a perfect fit, and giving them an option to grow and, you know, work in an empathetic and understanding environment has always been a helpful thing. But all too often, I remember that there was a group, I led for Samaya, Star Jacks in 2000, and there was a group that was meeting in the basement that were Samaya for 15 kids, and the goal was that we would take all of these young people, and there were sports, and there was learning, and there was activities, and they all left the Yeshiva High School system and were kind of searching. And I bumped into the person who was running that program, and we were just talking about it all the time. So I said, it's interesting, 14 of those original 15 kids ultimately ended up at Jack. It took between 5 and 9 years until they arrived at our door. It's very hard to help a person who doesn't want help. believe that that's an underlying problem, not just in the Orthodox community, but in the greater Jewish community as well, that you have a lot of people that Jesus loved, but Jesus is something else. So, I think that, like Jay's saying, at least we're hearing from that.
I'd like to ask Jay just for a closing remark.
Okay, I'm going to stick around, but I'd like to tell this little story because it kind of sums up a little bit about what we do. A father sitting there, he just gets home from work. I'm sure some of you have heard the story. He gets home from work, it's late. He's starting to read the newspaper. He's got three little ones there, 5, 7, and 9. They come over, Daddy, Daddy, take us to ice cream. Take us for ice cream. Father says, I'm not taking you for ice cream. We're having dinner in a little while. Maybe later, I'm reading the newspaper. Leave me alone. They go off. 5 minutes later, little one comes over. Daddy, Daddy, take us for ice cream. We want to go for ice cream now. I told you, I'm not taking you for ice cream. Leave me alone. I'm trying to relax and read the newspaper. We're having dinner in a few minutes. Go away. We'll talk to you after dinner. 5 minutes later, middle one comes over. Daddy, Daddy, take us for ice cream. Father's getting fed up. He's getting pissed off now. He looks at the newspaper and he sees a map of the world in the newspaper. He starts saying, I've got a brilliant idea. He starts tearing up the map of the world and throws it down on the kitchen table. And he says, if you guys can put the map of the world together, I'll take you out for ice cream. No problem, right? Knowing that, they've never even seen a map of the world, let alone put it all together. He goes back down. He's starting to read other piece of the newspaper. And he thinks, oh, my God, I've got like half an hour of freedom here. They're not going to bother me. 2 minutes later, the older one comes over and looks and says, Daddy, Daddy, take us for ice cream. He's very upset now. I can't believe it. Guys, I told you, go put the map of the world back together and I'll take you for ice cream. Knowing that, they go, Daddy, we did it. No problem. We put it all back. Father's amazed and shocked. He gets up. There's no way you could have done this. He looks and there it is. The map of the world is back together. He's so astounded. He said, how could you guys have, you must have cheated. You must have done something. How could you have put this map of the world back together so quickly? And the youngest one said, Daddy, Daddy, it was really easy. All we did on the other side was a picture of a man's face, and all we did was put the man back together, and the world fell into place. And I just want to say that's what we do at sessions like we're having tonight, and that's what we do at Jack's. And we try to help individuals have healthier and happier families. So thank you very much for having us tonight.
Thank you.
Lives are turned to chaos. And I just wanted to say that Jack's does provide a venue for people to be able to help people who are concerned members of the family. They can come, Jack provides that venue for them so that they can understand that they're.